Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Grace Victory. Grace won our Influencer of the Year at the Blogosphere Awards 2021.
So kind of to start with, I'd actually like to take you back to the awards night and you're on the Glean table. And what is going through your mind when your category is being like read out? Like what happened in that evening and like what's that?
Okay, honestly, all I kept thinking about was make sure you can walk and get onto the stage, because when you learn to walk again, well, for me anyway, I just have this thing where I'm like, what if my legs just stop working one day? I don't know why. Because obviously for awards and stuff, you get anxious and nervous, so you get like jiggly legs. Mm. But like for me, I felt like I was Bambi on ice. So I just literally was like focused on just walking and getting to the stage if your name is called.
And then it was called.
Yeah, I think I cried. I just felt really overwhelmed. Because obviously the beginning of that year was hell. I was in a coma. And then a few months later, I'm like back to normal, but I wasn't back to normal. I was still very early recovery and still processing everything, so it was just a lot for me, to be honest. That's why my partner came with me, but it was nice to kind of feel a bit normal too. But I definitely experience like social anxiety a bit more now, so going to events where there's a lot of people, I just immediately kind of go inward and like want to kind of be invisible. It's really odd. I think it's because I was in hospital for so long, you become institutionalized. So I'm only really seeing nurses, Lee and Cypress, you know?
Yeah.
And that was for about 5 months. So suddenly to see like hundreds of people, it was overwhelming. Mm. But also like really great, because I was like, I'm a winner. I loved my outfit, my makeup. We had a child-free night at a hotel, so the whole thing was great. Mm. But just overwhelming,
because when you won, like there has never been a reaction like that. Like,
no,
people were on their chairs screaming. Like, it gives me goose pimples, like, thinking about it. So it's like, as you're going on, and you've mentioned like being overwhelmed, that there was just so you know.
So I think much. I blacked out, because I just heard silence. I won, and then I just heard silence.
Wow.
And it wasn't,
silence.
Yeah. It wasn't until Lee was like the absolute noise in that room, because Lee was like tearing up on stage, because he was like, I just couldn't believe the reaction from people. But I can't remember it because I think I just blacked out.
Mm.
So, that, yeah, the, it the is moment. So surreal.
The moment between you two on stage, like, he looks at you, rubs your arm, gives you a wink. It was like,
I know. He's the best. I think it's really important for me to have people around me that are, like, my safety net. And obviously, even before I got unwell, Lee was my safety net. And then during the last, like, 18 months, he has been, like, I don't know, my constant and like just like the most incredible person ever. I love him a lot, so I'm very grateful that he was there with me on the stage.
So you're on stage 6 months before that, you're in a coma. 3 months before that, you know, you get sick. Can you like take us back to December 2020 and your memory of the events, how it unfolded?
Yeah. So, I got ill like late December. And it was no cough. It was none of the normal symptoms that people were reporting. I just was hot and cold and just felt like I couldn't take in a really big breath. So I went to maternity triage. I was there for 5 days and needing more and more oxygen support. Had a positive COVID test and had a C-section. So Cypress was fine. And then I obviously
at that point, did you realise how sick you were? When
no.
You, no.
No. I don't remember. The problem is I don't actually remember much because I think my oxygen was going so low that my brain was obviously just trying to cope. So it just blocked out a lot of stuff. And yeah, they said, oh, you're going to go to intensive care because you're needing more and more support. Or we just don't have the stuff in maternity. So I went to intensive care on Christmas Day. I had Cypress on Christmas Eve, and then Boxing Day they said, we're going to put you into a coma because your body needs to rest, like you're just too tired now. And apparently I consented. I was like, yeah, fine, but I have no recollection of that at all. And then I was actually doing really well in the coma for a while. And then I wasn't doing very well. I had an infection, but they couldn't find it, which apparently is very normal for the ICU.
Would that have been something that you picked up in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know the exact timeline, but I think I was woken up a few times and it kind of went a bit wrong. I was really anxious and was like trying to fight the nurses, which again is a normal reaction.
Yeah.
And then the second time they tried to wake me up, I woke up, wasn't well. They put me back under and then had cardiac arrest, and was dead for 5 minutes. And they found a clot in my lung, which explains why I had the cardiac arrest. But then within literally 10 days, I was completely recovered from it. So they can't really explain, like, what happened to me, really.
Yeah.
But obviously, COVID is basically pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
So my lungs filled with mucus that was too thick and solid for me to cough up. So a cough is a sign that you're actually, like, healthy, like,
yeah,
being able to bring things up, and I couldn't. During this time, I was also intubated, and then they realised that I was no longer comfortable being intubated. So they did the trachea, which is the tube, through my neck into my lungs. I responded really well to that. And then when I woke up, I was responding well, but had numerous infections. And then this is like now March, like the 20th of March.
Do you remember, so when you woke up, how long was it before you came back into your sort of conscious mind?
So I woke up for the final time in February because I remember telling my sister to order a card for Lee's birthday. And his birthday is February 26th.
Mm.
And he came in to see me on Valentine's Day. So I was obviously awake, but I wasn't there until I tweeted March 8th, when I felt like I was out of the red zone.
Yeah.
I didn't want to tweet and be public being still very, like, severely ill.
Mm.
So I knew then, you know, March 8th, by then I was on FaceTime to, like, my family and my friends, and I knew that I was doing better. And then I think I met Cypress the 21st of March. And I think people want me to say that it was, like, the best day of my life and it was fantastic, but it wasn't.
Mm.
It was really anxiety-inducing for me, sad, bittersweet. My baby was, like, inside me, and then suddenly he's, like, 3 months old and he didn't feel like mine.
Mm.
So that day was, like, the worst day. That night I was so depressed and I had really, like, suicidal thoughts. But at the same time, I think it kind of jolted me to like want to really, really, really get out of hospital.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later, my trachea got taken out and I could breathe again. So the recovery time in hindsight was quite quick, but I'm pretty sure it's because I was so determined to get home to my baby.
Mm. Did you, I mean, you talked about that a lot of people kind of want you to say that that was the best day, and yeah, that actually a lot of people kind of want you to be like, I'm so lucky. But
yeah,
is that, but actually, I mean, it's pretty unlucky that the whole thing happened to you in the first place. So yeah, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, there's a lot of noise from people and, you know, press and social media and even just people on the street that come up to me. There's a lot of, you know, we're so happy you're alive and like you're a miracle. And like, I'm like, even hospital, I got told all the time from doctors, oh, you're a miracle, you're a miracle. But for some reason, it puts even more pressure on me. I can't really explain it, but it's like a survivor's guilt. You do think, why me sometimes? And I'm still coming to terms with the fact that there are moments where I don't feel grateful to be alive because of the sheer trauma that I'm experiencing, the PTSD, the flashbacks. I still can't look at Cypress's photos from before I saw him for the first time again because it's too painful, because I'm like, I don't recognise that baby boy because I wasn't there. And I think some people have tried to put me on like a COVID pedestal and want me to be the spokesperson for COVID and, you know, this like wave the flag for survivors, which is great and I understand. But also I think that part of my healing is actually like letting that go,
yeah,
and learning to live again, like for myself and with my family.
And not being defined solely by this.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to be like the girl that just lived. I don't want to be the COVID survivor. Like there's so many other parts of me that I want people to see and know. And I think moving forward, that will be the next part of my journey, is actually like letting go of the trauma trademark, if you will.
Yeah.
And like learning to live again.
What do you think has been the most important part of your recovery, you know, both physically and mental health wise? Your biggest sort of learning during this time?
I think mental health wise, I think before I got ill, I was very unhappy with certain aspects of my life. So my work-life balance, some friendships and relationships, and I was kind of stuck and unable to move forward and unable to change. And this big, you know, traumatic event has actually made my life a lot better. There are things that I'm still working through, and I'll be in therapy for a very long time, but I have seen the change in myself, and I will never ever choose work over family, which is what I used to do before. I would, you know, not go to friends' birthday parties, not go to family functions, just because I was so addicted to the chase and the grind. And I think it's coming from, you know, being working class. You know, you're kind of taught work hard, make money to get out of your hometown, etc. And that's been instilled in me. So my whole life has been about working and getting out. And I got ill and it kind of gave me this wake up call that actually I can create the life that I want and I don't have to run away from my problems all of the time. And yeah, I was able to face things head on. And when you're just in hospital for so long, and you're just having physio and therapy, you don't have other things to do. So there's a lot of times where, you know, I'll obviously scroll on TikTok and Twitter, but there was a lot of time for me to think and feel and talk with people. And yeah, I'm learning to like enjoy my life now and like welcome peace, because, you know, my life has been chaotic for so long. So mentally, that's been the most eye-opening thing.
And with the, just on the therapy, you've had the same therapist since 2017.
Yeah.
Was that the same therapist you were speaking to remotely whilst in hospital?
Yeah. As soon as I left the ICU, so my trachea was out and I could speak, I texted him and I was like, I need to speak to you. And he called me and we had an hour's like FaceTime on my phone. And I was just crying, like, I couldn't breathe. I was crying so much. And he was crying too. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a therapist, like, show, like, proper emotion.
Mm.
And I was just telling him, like, about my coma dreams. And he is the only person, really, in my life that I can tell everything to, like my deepest, darkest secrets and things about my relationships, you know, the shame that I feel about not being able to breastfeed, all of these things that aren't easy to talk about, he's the one person that I tell things to.
Mm.
So I was just like word vomiting out.
And during the COVID dreams, you had very traumatic ones. Were there any good ones as well, or was it literally just a nightmare?
Coma dream was a continuously long one dream. It was a story.
Yeah.
And in the story, I was sex trafficked. So it was basically like watching a thriller on TV or in the cinema. And it was absolutely just horrific, basically. And it was actually the hardest part of my recovery process was dealing with the dreams, because I remember my dreams as memory, not as a dream.
Yeah.
It's real to me. These things happen to me in a dimension. You know, for example, in one scene in the dream, I was pushed into a river and then I died. And there was a lot of water in my dreams, and I found out that my bed was a waterbed in hospital. So loads of these things were happening in my dreams that were sort of happening in real life.
Mm.
So yeah, the subconscious mind is mental, and I just needed to work through all of that with him. And I think from maybe April to August was crisis management. It was just, I was just in sheer shock, really. My PTSD was pretty horrendous. And physically, the thing that has been the most eye-opening is that you can like not walk and then you can walk. Like, it blows my mind how quickly your body can remember how to do things. Mm. And how capable your body actually is. Like, I had a PICC line through my arm into my heart, which is like a long thin plastic tube to take blood samples. So I had that in. I had a catheter. At one point I had a balloon thing in my bum to catch feces. All these things, you know, cannulas. I was on fentanyl. I had a clot in my lung. Like, all these things can be healed, and it just blows my mind.
Mm.
Like, that can actually happen. And you just kind of feel like, wow, last year I was like, wow, I really learned to walk again this year. That's just crazy.
Have you found the physical recovery versus, well, like, how have you found the physical versus the mental in terms of what's been like?
So much easier.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. I think the physical recovery, in the very beginning, was very, very, very hard. And then I was discharged and I had no choice but to get better mm-hmm. because I was at home, I had a baby, I had to learn to do things again, and then it got better very quickly.
So you can see that progress.
Yeah, I pushed myself a lot. I'd go for a walk every day with Cypress's pram so that if I felt uneasy, I had something to hold on to. Mm-hmm. I'd do that every single day for my lungs, for my walking, and I would just try all of the time. But with mental health, it's not like that. It's like a very long process of talking about things, revisiting the past, learning to be present. It's an ongoing thing. Mm. Whereas physically, I'm basically recovered, apart from I've got a dodgy thumb in my left hand.
Yeah.
But apart from that, like, the physical thing has been great, really. Mm.
And with the PTSD, how does that sort of manifest itself? Is that this kind of leaning into the social anxiety elements, or just...
Yeah, so I get, like, anxiety. In the beginning, it was a lot of flashbacks. When you first wake up from a coma, you have hallucinations. So I am still trying to work out what was real, what I actually saw, and what's completely in my head. So that's can be quite hard, but it's not as traumatizing as it was in the beginning. But I used to struggle with day-to-day life, to be honest, because just watching TV and seeing someone in a hospital gown would trigger me, and it still does a little bit now. Mm. And just learning to, like, be again after, like, I didn't get dressed for 5 months. I didn't wear knickers mm-hmm. for 5 months. My feet were swollen, so I couldn't even wear trainers. I went up from, like, a size 6 to a size 8 in shoes because my feet were so swollen. And all these things are really hard because you feel like your body isn't yours, and that can really affect you, especially with someone like me who's had an eating disorder. I've worked really hard on reclaiming my body and having body autonomy, and suddenly that was kind of taken away from me. So there's lots of factors, and panic attacks, just feeling really overwhelmed, and kind of not knowing where to put these feelings. And then I just, have a breakdown. But I know that it gets easier, you know. Yeah. I've been in therapy for a very long time, and I kind of know how things go. They sometimes do get hard before they get better. So I'm just going with it, and I'm showing up for myself, and I'm kind of working through my stuff, you know?
And then in terms of your family and those closest to you, mm-hmm. they were sort of in peak, just, we have to look after, you know, figure out what's going on. Then you do recover physically, you're on that road to recovery. Then does it hit them later? Yeah. Like, how have they been?
Mm. I think it's harder for the families in the coma, because you're somewhat unaware of what's happening. Like, I never, ever felt any pain, ever. Even when I woke up, even when I was learning to walk, I never had any pain. So I don't really feel much. But obviously when your parents and your family and friends are watching you through the screen and you look half dead, I think at one point they said I was purple. It's very, very hard. And I think especially for my partner, so Lee, obviously he's got this newborn baby, and I am the control freak in our relationship. So I had everything organised. I take the lead on a lot of things in our life because I am the organised person. So suddenly, you know, me not being there, he's got this child, hasn't got a clue what he's doing. And he tells me, like, all the time that it was the most loneliest part of his life. And we are two peas in a pod. So it was really, really hard for him. And he's now on his own journey with getting help, because I think he was in survival mode. And then I woke up. He was coming to visit me every single day at one point, plus looking after our baby. And then I got discharged, but I couldn't use the toilet properly. He had to literally work my ass for like a month. I couldn't obviously cook. I couldn't make bottles yet. I couldn't stand for longer than maybe 3 minutes. So then for the summertime, up until about July, August, he was still my carer, really. Yeah. And it wasn't until probably December where he started to feel all the things he needed to feel. And I think it's going to be a long journey for both of us. But luckily, we have like a great support system, and my team are incredible and they look out for us. And we still get, you know, calls and texts from our medical team. And I say "our" because the team that looked after Cypress in the NICU, obviously, you know, they were with Lee quite a lot, and they still keep tabs on us, and I love it. Mm. And whenever I need any advice from like my consultants, I just text them. Like, that is how we are now. And they're incredible, and they've helped Lee with the stuff that's going on for him. But it is difficult, and I don't think you're ever the same again, to be honest.
You've talked about how it has redefined your relationship with work and your work-life balance. What kind of hasn't been mentioned lots is, as a creator, that you are self-employed. And I remember watching your Instagram live from the hospital, and just what the, you know, you're self-employed. So what happened work-wise and what was the impact on you financially?
I had worked so much the year before that financially I was in the best place ever. So obviously we had no outgoings really because we weren't doing anything. So my accountant and Lee were on emails with each other. And thank the heavens, we just didn't worry about money. I didn't work for 6 months.
Did brands, though, that you were working with continue? So did you have, like, ambassadorships that carried on?
Yeah.
Because I suppose so, then one-off stuff just went.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the brands that I'd worked with paid me my fee, even if I couldn't upload the final post or whatever it was. And I sometimes think there's just someone up there looking out for us because we didn't worry. Lee didn't have to worry. There was a substantial amount of money, basically, in our savings account. And then I woke up, and I knew, like, very early on that I needed to get back into work. Not for money, but just to feel normal.
Yeah.
Just to have something to do. And obviously, you know, I couldn't work for a while, so for 6 months I didn't make any money. But I didn't really care or think about it as much.
Mm.
I knew that we were fine. And the thing with me is that I am organised. I knew I was going to have maternity leave, have a baby. I needed money in my account. So it was just there, you know, and Lee managed, you know, his money, etc., etc. But yeah, you don't think about waking up one day and not being able to make money as a creator and being self-employed. But what I will say is that the HMRC, like, fined me thousands and thousands of pounds for not paying my tax bill on time, even though I was in a coma. So we had to contest that. It took literally about a year. It's come through recently that they have accepted my contestment and that they're going to refund me all the money I paid. But it's been difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
they, yeah, that was just,
it was just added stress, you know?
Yeah.
But like my landlord was incredible, because I think Lee couldn't get into my bank account at one point and he needed to pay someone something, I think because the rent comes out of my account. And the agency and the landlord were great, and they actually got us our new flat where we live now, because I couldn't do the stairs in our old flat. So everyone sort of rallied around. My accountant was incredible, Gleam were incredible, and everyone made sure that we didn't have to worry. Even down to moving, Fantastic Services helped us move. They packed up our whole flat. Brands would pretty much do anything they could to help, and it was incredible. Even just waking up and seeing my Twitter feed and everyone like sending me prayers and well wishes, it's amazing what people can do when you are, you know, the shit's at the fan, basically.
I think it's when you see the best in people and then the worst, HMRC. Just like looking more broadly now at your career, when did becoming a creator become professional?
2015, I went full time.
And when did you start?
2011. And 2015, I was absolutely broke. I was poor. Looking back, I'm just like, you had no savings, but I just thought, well, I've got to make it work. So I moved out into my first flat, went self-employed, and I think the first month I made like £2,000 and was like, yes, like I'm on my way. And then 2016 was, I would say, when body positivity was kind of on the rise, and more plus size creators were coming out, and people were getting interested in more taboo subjects. And I was kind of doing a lot of those topics and creating content based on those things. So that's when I kind of gained more followers and getting brand deals.
What was your first brand deal?
My first brand deal was with a beauty subscription company, My Beauty Compare, I think it was. And then my second was E45. And then it kind of went on from there. And then I got like a TV show, and then a book deal. And then now I'm here.
And how have sort of brand deals changed in that time? Like there's quite a lot of noise at the moment about the influencer pay gap and Black creators in particular being paid less than their white counterparts. Have you experienced that?
Oh my God, 100%. It's, yeah, I have. I would say the money I'm making now is what my thin white influencer friends were making 4 or 5 years ago. There's a massive, massive, massive divide. I think more than people actually realise. And my team are very honest with me, and they say the fight they do for me compared to their white talent is just remarkable.
Do you think that's where the answer is in the... Yeah, because lots of people don't have talent managers either. So, you know, what is the solution? How do we get there?
I think it's people need to talk more. There's like this really weird awkwardness around money, I think just in general, but people don't want to, you know, say what they're earning or what they got paid. But something that I've been doing for years is, you know, a few creators that have the same amount of following as me and engagement, we talk about money and what we got offered and stuff. And that kind of helps, because transparency, I think, is really key when it comes to this. And someone fighting your corner, having a team behind you that can talk the talk. Because I don't know about, you know, how to negotiate fees and money and contracts and usage rights. That's what my team is for. So yeah, transparency and people, you know, backing you and being behind you.
It's quite a UK thing, being a bit funny talking about money, whereas yeah. like in the US they're much better at being like, this is exactly what
yeah.
you paid.
Yeah, exactly. But brand deals now, I think, just with, you know, the time and the growing of the industry, but for me personally, I only really do jobs now that are long term.
Yeah.
And are more ambassador type roles, just because I don't have time to constantly shoot content. I've got a baby, I'm still recovering, and also I don't want to, like I can't be asked. So I like to know what I'm doing weeks in advance. I like to take my time with shooting, and, you know, going on events or press trips or whatever. And I just think for me, I like organic, long-term relationships.
Yeah.
Hence why I work with certain brands for months on end, even years. That's what works for me. And then you know what money's coming in.
Yeah.
And it just means I've got more brain space to be a mum.
Mm.
And also just live my life offline.
I think it resonates better with the audience as well when you're in a long-term partnership.
Yeah.
You know? And I think this is where hopefully influence marketing is progressing, and people aren't just putting a little bit of money in and then just expecting it to, you know, get these
yeah.
incredible results, that actually people need to be, I think it's like the data is like you need to sort of be hit by something 7 times before
right.
you actually go and kind of make
yeah.
the purchase.
And I think as well, like for me, it's not all about, like, I hate working with brands, and I won't work with brands that just want to see sales from the content. I'm not that kind of person. You're not going to get thousands of sales from me, but I'm endorsing a product and I think I'm a good person.
Yeah.
So I collaborate with brands that, you know, are about, you know, diversity, are about inclusivity, are about like substance, empowerment, brands that want a story, or they want a journey. Because so yeah, I think moving forward, I love to see more collaborations where it's not about like buy this product, more about
yeah.
like, you know,
then that has such a value to it as well. I think that we do have some marketers that want to make the influence marketing piece performance marketing. So it's like
yeah.
they want to have their spreadsheet and be like, this is the conversion, but actually it's a human industry. It's not just putting on a Facebook ad. What you're
yeah.
investing in is someone that's put years and years into their content and developed, you know, it's the trust, it's the audience,
yeah.
it's the affiliation.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely with you there. Just on having the team behind you and management, you are with Gleam. Have you
yeah.
had managers before Gleam? What are your experiences and advice to someone thinking about getting management?
Yeah, I've had management before Gleam, and I was very happy there, to be honest. But I think sometimes you just need change. And I went with Gleam because I felt as if they could position me in a different light, and, you know, work with me to do bigger and better things. And they're great. I absolutely love my team. They just get it. And I think it's important for a lot of creators to, if they want to, have someone who can push them into the right rooms, get them the right campaigns, the money they deserve to make. And Gleam do that for me. And I think that being self-employed and in this industry is very, very, very stressful. And you can get lost sometimes in the hype, in the source. You compare yourselves, you start making content that you don't want to make, but it's because it's growing on Instagram, it's a trend. And having people behind you, backing you, supporting you, just talking to you, because it's very lonely. You are really a one-man band. And having someone that you can discuss content ideas with and things you'd like to do, and they can make it happen. And Gleam's tagline is "Let's make it happen," which I love.
Mm.
Is beneficial, and there is a lot of power in collaborations and working with people. You haven't got to do it on your own all the time. I really recommend management. I don't know what I would do without them, especially with contracts. Like, I ain't got a clue.
Yeah.
So
What are your favourite platforms at the moment? Like, you're big on Instagram, you mentioned scrolling through TikTok earlier, and you've deleted old YouTube content, so...
Yeah. So I deleted old YouTube content because I wanted to just start again, really. I think when you're making content for 11, 12 years, there's stuff that you just don't want to be online anymore. And that's absolutely normal and fine. And it's not... the you know, like, when we were children, no one saw, like, your teenage life or, you know, early years on the internet. So there's certain things I just removed because I didn't want them to be online anymore. And I wanted to start again and fresh and kind of rebrand my channel. Because, to be honest, YouTube hasn't been a platform that I've enjoyed for a very long time. And I knew that I wanted it even before I got ill.
Why?
I just think it's so hard to be consistent on there. And the trolls are quite horrific on there. And it's a platform that doesn't come very easy to me. Whereas Instagram and Twitter is easy and organic and it flows. Whereas YouTube can be quite forced. And I knew a long time ago that if I was going to remain on that platform, it would be to share family life.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What are YouTube your views on TikTok?
So, I find creating content on TikTok really hard. Really hard. But I love watching content. I think it's my most used platform. I love it. And that's because you can see everyone on there. From every race, every size, every background, every country, it feels like. It's just great.
It feels like it's very much entertainment as well. You know, yeah. It's not just aesthetic.
Yeah, I love it. So my favourite, I think, is Instagram and Twitter, just because it's what I tend to go to share content, and it's easier for me and it flows. But I think it changes all the time. Like, sometimes I think, oh, I can't stand Instagram. And I think it's really, really important to, you know, love what you do and like your job, but also like your life. And there's so much of my life, believe it or not, that's not online that I don't share. And I love that. And I find that I'm more content with my life when it's just for me and, like, my in real life people.
Mm. And then finally, you're, like, relieved I've got you. We've got 8 minutes to go. What are your goals professionally and personally over the next year?
I think I would like to connect with more brands on an ambassadorship long-term.
Do you have brands in mind? Or
I really want to do a hair campaign. I feel like my hair story is really good. You know, yeah. I had long blonde, big curly hair. It's in great condition. And then it got matted in my coma. I had to shave my hair off. And I would love to do a really amazing, like, long-term hair campaign around identity, hair care, hair growth, etc., etc. So I'd love to do something like that. I would love my own jewellery collection.
Would that be a collaboration, or have you considered creating your own line as well? Because there is quite a big rise in creators creating their own brands and doing direct to consumer.
There is, but that is so expensive that I cannot. I think my next big thing is buying a house. And having that kind of security for Cyprus and then future children that we have. So that's what I'm focusing on in terms of, like, paying out. But I would love to do, like, a licensing deal with a brand around hair, maybe, and jewellery. I really want to do, like, a gold, size-inclusive jewellery collaboration. Because I love gold jewellery. And a book, some more TV. My, like, end goal is Strictly Come Dancing, because I just feel like I would be amazing on Strictly Come Dancing. So I love to do Strictly. And honestly, I'm just sort of taking things day by day. Obviously, I have goals and I've got dreams and aspirations, but life is unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen. So I'm just sort of enjoying my time for now, and just, you know, trying to be a great mom and be healthy, and I want to show Cyprus the world and travel a bit. So for me, it's not even about my career goals at the moment. It's more about changing the narrative around, you know, what it means to be a survivor. I'd love to do some work with the NHS around the ICU and making it a better place for patients, especially those of colour. And I guess kind of using my voice, you know, and just living, just being me.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com.